is recognized by Chloe Goodison, a health sciences student at Simon Fraser University who began the organization during her first year of university in 2021. CJSF recently sat down with Goodison to discuss what inspired her to start Naloxone, the work that they continue to do, as well as the ways in which she hopes that the organization is able to grow beyond BC. Please take a listen. I'm joined here in studio with Chloe Goodison, the founder of Naloxone, and I think the first thing I want to ask you is if you can explain to people what Naloxone is and how you came about starting it.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me. Naloxone Society is a registered Canadian charity that I started almost 4 years ago when I was in my first year at Simon Fraser University, actually. It is a education service, and we go into high schools. Teachers can book us anywhere across Canada, but we really target British Columbia. And we can go in and we provide drug education and naloxone training workshops in response to British Columbia's ongoing and deadly growing overdose epidemic. We're a team of all youth, so I have a team of 85, 18 to 25-year-olds on my team, and we go in and provide peer-to-peer, youth-to-youth drug education and naloxone training.
You said you started this in your first year.
Yeah.
How does a first-year university student even think to start a nonprofit society?
Very good question, and it kind of happened by fluke, if I'm being honest. So when I was in high school, I first of all, the overdose crisis was declared in 2016, which mm-hmm. is the year that I started grade 9. And it was grade 10 going into grade 11 that I was on public transportation, knew nothing about the overdose crisis, had maybe heard the word, and I witnessed an overdose, which is not rare. It's not a news flash story that I saw. We've probably all walked past somebody experiencing a drug poisoning. And this is what really got me involved in the realm of drug poisonings and harm reduction. And I really was surprised that I was witnessing this in my own community of Port Moody, British Columbia. In my head, I thought all drug use and overdoses were isolated to the downtown east side, and this was just a preconceived stigma that I had based on basically no exposure to drug education. Then I entered my first year of university in 2020, so it was online, and I did have a little bit more free time because there wasn't volunteer opportunities in clubs and sports happening. So basically, I was scrolling on Facebook one night, and I saw an ad from SFU's Office of Community Engagement that they run an annual community engagement competition. It's called the Student Community Engagement Competition. And this is an opportunity where you can enter a idea of something, a way to fix a problem in your community. You have to identify community partners you've connected with, and you can compete to win $3,000 to implement this community project. So I thought, okay, well, I've been volunteering in harm reduction for a while. I saw this drug overdose on SkyTrain a few years ago, and nobody knew what to do, despite it being a declared overdose crisis. How can I find a way to provide accessible and equitable drug education with naloxone training that youth will actually listen to? So I got 12 of my friends, all also in first year, and we met up on Zoom, and we just had this idea, and we just brainstormed a curriculum and what items are important to talk about to youth. What should youth be knowing about our drug overdose crisis? And I won that competition. And since then, we registered as a society. We've got a lot more funding than $3,000. And like I said before, we've grown our team to over 80 people.
How do you develop the presentations?
That's a great question. So really, in that original brainstorming session I had with the team I put together at the very beginning, we went through the topics that we thought had to be included. Like, how do we give youth a very well-rounded understanding of this problem? And it starts with talking about stigma and talking about, you know, what are the current ideas we have around people who use drugs, and what... is that true? And we walked through some language swap outs that we can use. Instead of saying addicts or junkies, we say people who use drugs or people who are in a relationship with a substance. So it's really starting at ground zero there, and then working into talking about harm reduction and what is harm reduction in a non-drug related sense. You know, do you ride your bike? Do you wear a helmet? Do you put sunscreen on in the summer? All examples of harm reduction. It just makes sense. in the same way that naloxone or drug checking services just make sense. They keep people alive. From there, we really wanted to get into some statistics around how hard-hitting the overdose crisis is in all parts of our province, not just the downtown east side, not just Surrey Central, every pocket of the province. And then the bread and butter of the presentation is the naloxone training. So we took this presentation to a partner we had at the Tri-Cities Community Overdose Action Team, where it's a team of different community members and problem solvers, like a Fraser Health official, a SHARE Family and Community Services representative. And they looked over our presentation and trained us on how to deliver it in a sensitive and culturally safe way. And from there, we trained each other and just launched in and made sure everything in our presentation was 100% science-backed and accurate.
Yeah, would you say part of that stigma, too, is taking away some of that fear of even being around naloxone itself?
Oh, 100%. You know, something we've had a lot of parents and students say before they've actually seen our presentation is that carrying naloxone is enabling substance use, which is so incorrect. And we definitely found that students have been scared to. We've actually found that 75% of students didn't know about naloxone and didn't know how to use it, didn't know you could get it for free. So we're really myth-busting that and just providing that education that students can go get a life-saving naloxone kit. But there is that the portion of students, too, who are scared, and they're scared of needles, which is fair. And we've educated them that there's multiple kinds of naloxone available, not just needle naloxone. But I'd really say that there's still that public misconception that harm reduction enables substance use and that drug education in schools enables substance use, but it does not. It's not correlated with increased substance use initiation.
There was pretty recent data from the province saying that there's apparently been a significant decline in drug deaths within BC, about 9% since last year. Would you say that's kind of like a statistical anomaly, or is there any sort of, I guess, information you have, you know, with the work that you do that may provide some insight on that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's a mixed reaction for me, because, of course, part of me is like, oh, my gosh, something is maybe working, like something is contributing to a decrease in deaths. But it's still way too many deaths. These are our family members, our community members, our loved ones who are dying at higher rates than anything else. You know, this is still our leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 59 in British Columbia. So as much as we can maybe hold on to a sliver of hope that something's working to decrease, whether it's, you know, increased access to harm reduction services or less people using alone, hopefully those elements that maybe are happening are continuing. But we also have to remember this is every single drug poisoning death is preventable, and there are still far too many happening.
Yeah, it's such a multifaceted issue, but I guess with naloxone specifically, I think it seems like the part that you're trying to address is like the stigma around it and making sure that drug education matches the seriousness and the prevalence of the issue.
100%. You know, I never questioned receiving sexual education in school. It's just what you do. You learn, you teach young people how to make informed and empowered decisions about their own health and safety, same way you would about substance use. And by continuing to put our heads in the sand and pretending that talking about drug education in schools is just going to make youth want to use drugs, that's not the truth. And we have to provide young people with the tools to not just prevent and recognize, but also respond to an overdose. Because personally, if I had received this workshop in school, I probably would have thought right off the bat, I don't use drugs that I'm at risk of illicit drug toxicity with. So this isn't going to connect to me. But how we've tried to navigate that narrative is by saying we can all witness it. This is our leading cause of death. Over 35,000 people call 911 each year for suspected overdose. We're all at risk of witnessing an overdose. So knowing how to not just prevent and recognize, but respond, carrying naloxone, saving a life, it's important.
And yeah, like you said, I guess comparing it also to just other basic safety protocols that we just have in our daily lives that are so normalized and feel like second nature, getting to that point.
Totally.
Last question I want to ask you is if you have current plans or aspirations for how you want naloxone to grow past even BC, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, what I've learned is that there's a need right across Canada, North America, really, for youth-to-youth delivered substance use education. And yes, there are other vehicles of substance use education. You have your programs that preach just say no. You have your programs that are led by police officers coming in and using scare tactics. Our overdose numbers have really just gone up. Of course, yes, there was a bit of a decrease, but that's not because of the DARE program. So yes, we need to find a way to scale this model of having young people just chatting with their peers about how, hey, drug use is happening. These are the tools available to keep you alive. So, I mean, next steps are really just expanding our in-person operations province-wide. Right now, we're pretty far across Metro Vancouver. We'll do anything Vancouver to Mission in person. But, you know, getting an island branch, getting a northern health branch, a interior branch going, just so we can really get into those rural and remote communities that are so disproportionately affected by our drug poisoning crisis. And after that, it's hopping into other provinces. Every single day I have emails from Alberta, Manitoba, Ontario, these awesome community advocates who see the work we're doing and recognize that there's nothing else like it, and they want to develop Naloxone Society branches of their own out in their regions. So that's really the next step, just scaling and capacity building and fundraising for that. But I'm continuously impressed and motivated by the community support. We've had an overwhelming number of people cheer us on, and a very, very slim number of people who do not agree with the work we're doing. So I'm definitely motivated, to say the least.
I know I said last question, but I guess last thing is, you know, you're still in school. You're a student at Simon Fraser University. Yeah. Post-graduation, is the plan to really focus on naloxone and the ways that it can expand?
Yeah, oh, 100%. So I'm just finishing up my Bachelor of Science in Health Sciences right now, and I'm so grateful to be part of a faculty that's so understanding of the work I'm doing, and they're so supportive. And, you know, my professors are always asking me questions and engaging with me and understanding that I do work, this is my full-time job. So balancing the full-time student course load with the full-time entrepreneurial lifestyle, I suppose, is challenging, but I find ways to take breaks. However, it will be very nice once I have achieved that Bachelor of Science and I have it, and then I can, you know, really be full-time and continue scaling this out and driving this change, and eventually, you know, stepping out of the role, and I probably want to do more school. So finding who's next to lead this youth-run organization and what other change can happen under other leadership. But that's way in the future. I'm here for now.
Once again, that was our interview with Chloe Goodison, Executive Director and Founder of Naloxone. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This interview would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something every day, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m. Your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
We're here to talk about the Barbie movie.
Oh, yes. I'm going to start indirectly, because I got to, it'll put in context what I have to say about the film. Mm-hmm. Now, I got something. Gloria Steinem, in 2014 was in a panel discussion with the Grace of Will and Grace, the actress that played it, and Mariel Thomas, who later married Phil Donahue. I guess he's the widow now because Phil Donahue died. But prior to marrying Phil Donahue, Mariel Thomas was in a situation comedy called That Girl.
Yep.
And, you remember this one.
I do.
And it just was predated the Mary Tyler Moore Show by 2 years. It went from 1968 to 1972, approximately. And then the very first Mary Tyler Moore Show, I kind of like it, not quite. Mm-hmm. Not quite. Anyway, so during this 2014 conference, the feminist Gloria Steinem said about the situation comedy, That Girl, television of the time did not reflect the reality of the 1960s. What was on television was not what was, but what should be, in view of censors, Steinem said. In order to appeal to women who were divorced, they had to show shows about widows. You had to knock off the husband to make it okay for a woman to be single. Girls could not live alone. It was forbidden. So for Marlowe to do what she did was a major, was a big time major revolution. So she is contending that the situation comedy, That Girl, is a major revolution. Well, I kind of don't see that. Mm-hmm. I see that the show, it just fostered your basic stereotypes. I mean, it was you slightly remember this, Magnus?
Yep.
And what did you think of the show? What do you remember of it? It seemed to be, she's trying to hit it big in the big time in New York City. She has a boyfriend, I think he's an agent, or trying to help her get into show business on Broadway. And I don't see this as really, it's the typical sexist views of the time. I don't know. I mean, maybe you have some other input on this.
Yeah, I would have seen that show in reruns.
I saw it the first time around on a black and white TV set on the CTV network, since we didn't have cable to begin with.
But I do think I think what Gloria Steinem's getting at there is that it showed a young woman living on her own, working a career or trying to get a career started. I don't remember exactly the details. She wasn't married, so she did have a boyfriend, but she wasn't married. They didn't live together. They weren't like a unit. She was a single woman living on her own, right?
Right.
Which is different than, say, 10 years before that, you really only had sort of family comedies, right? It'd be the husband and the wife and often the kids. And even, what would have been groundbreaking, not groundbreaking, that's too strong a word, but, the first kind of show to break a bit of that mold without breaking it entirely, was like the Dick Van Dyke Show, perhaps, just because, Mary Tyler Moore, who played Dick Van Dyke's wife in that show, still a wife at home, but she seemed to have her own life as well. But still primarily a wife and mother. So this show coming on later, where now she's an independent woman, then you go from that to the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where, she's someone with a career, competing on, it's been a while since I watched the show, I'm going to say an even level. Yeah. But, also still, I'm sure encountering all the regular limitations of sexism of the time. But, her primary role in that show was as this woman working in the newsroom. She wasn't a wife. She wasn't a mother. She wasn't anything else. She was, the show was about her in her workplace, with a career.
Well, I'm going to touch briefly on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. There are some episodes where the sexism of Lou Grant is treated as kind of a joke. Mm-hmm. Like, it's sort of okay, he says one episode, well, women are supposed to be paid less. And that's presented as a joke. And one would say if this was truly a from a real feminist point of view, it would not be seen as a joke. Just a few episodes are like that.
Yeah.
That's the point I would have to...
It's been a while since I've seen it, but would that not have been a bit like, you know, the Archie Bunker character where they needed somebody to, you know, embody the actual views of the time, right? And say those things out loud, because that's what loads of people thought in the 70s.
Okay, I mean, it's kind of a fine point. I would say that it was sort of not... directly addressing the issue. I mean, that's it. I mean, okay. That's the point I wanted to make about it.
Yeah. So you watched the Barbie movie.
No, wait a minute. I got to say something else about Gloria Steinem.
Okay.
Okay, now, this was what she said about Norman Mailer. And I'm going to fill in a bit about Norman Mailer. This was after he died. Okay, so Gloria Steinem, after Norman Mailer died, sort of Norman Mailer, he wasn't hostile like ultra-right-wing anti-feminists, but he just didn't get it. But he will leave an absence because he was an original. He was a wonderful writer. Now, during the late 60s, both Steinem, Gloria Steinem, and Norman Mailer, and actually Tom Wolfe, wrote, to not be confused with New Yorker, it is called New York Magazine, and you can even get it at the Burnaby Library, even though it's primarily for people living in New York or New York State. Yeah. So she had some involvement with Norman Mailer. Now Norman Mailer, approximately 1960, when he was trying to run for mayor of New York, he got really upset. I think he got drunk. He was walking around town. There was a party for him. It looked like he was going to lose, and he was actually punching people on the actual street. And then he came home, and he was a litter opener, stabbed his wife in the stomach. It was inches from killing her.
Yeah.
And what had happened was that he had what happened was Time magazine originally did a pretty good report saying, you know, this isn't really good. And supposedly they got this outpouring of letters saying, oh, he wrote The Naked and the Dead. Oh, can you say this about him? And so he got out of it. If you're the ordinary person like you, Magnus, you would still be in jail now, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and he's sort of saying sexist comments towards the 1960s. She, I think, backed up his run for mayor at one point, Gloria Steinem, in the late 60s. I mean, I kind of find it questionable her involvement with Norman Mailer. Here's something about Ms. Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Which started in 1972. Now, Betty Friedan was against it being created.
Mm-hmm.
I read the last Gloria Steinem book from 2016. So I maybe wrote a book since then, but and she just said, "Well, some people like Betty Friedan, who was also a feminist, did not really agree with Ms. Magazine being created." Now, years later, Gloria Steinem said, well, we had to get rid of all the advertising in Ms. Magazine because these were of a lot of the beauty products and so on that were kind of that basically don't work. You know what I mean? Like, so, and I think they even had cigarette ads. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is probably why Betty Friedan was against it being created in 1972. Because they knew there's an expression to make an omelet, you have to break a few eggs. So maybe you don't need an omelet. I don't know. But I mean, by her own admission, Ms. Magazine operated hypocritically in a way because it did have the advertising that was not really kind of, you know, the beauty products and so on. Now, mind you, right now, Ms. Magazine, which is at my local Walmart at the Lougheed Mall Walmart, So you could say, well, it was a good argument. They had to do that a number of years. Now we have it. It basically has no advertising, and it's something that's available. It's available in a way that probably wouldn't be available. Mm-hmm. Now, so I really don't buy into this movie, this Barbie movie, being like a feminist film. I know Robin does. And I kind of indirectly, I'm giving you examples of how, like, was That Girl. I don't really buy into that being a feminist TV show either. The thing is that I think it was damage control for the phenomenality of Barbie itself, which started in 1958. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like the film. It's sort of damage control of the whole phenomenality of it. I mean, before 1958, there was no doll that a child would a girl would buy that created a body image problem. I mean, it didn't exist until Barbie. And also Barbie, I don't like the fact that they got all these expensive little shoes to buy and all this. On Sunday, I went to the Toys R Us on Broadway, close to Oak.
Yep.
And mind you, that's a really big store for toys.
Yep.
But they had the studio we're in now could barely have all of the Barbie products.
Yep.
And you're talking about $65 for, you know, the little van and all this. And I see this, it's actually some other issue. It's the exploitation, like you get a child to really want a toy, and I see exploitation there. Interestingly, what I saw on sale was like a Barbie that was in a wheelchair. There was a black Barbie. I don't think there was an Oriental one.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see an overweight Barbie, you know. So I sort of don't quite buy into it. Robin probably would disagree with me. I think it.
I'm sure she has her critiques as well, but. Anyway.
I know. Well, she seemed to be happy with them. I think it's doing damage. It's kind of make it like there's expression. Just because you talk guilty does not make you innocent. And I think that the movie, if you see the whole movie, kind of talks guilty about itself. Mm-hmm. Like a Barbie goes in the real world and she meets this girl, teenager, and says, oh, Barbie's terrible. Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, and then. It's kind of so ridiculous what happens then. But anyway, but it sort of talks guilty. It's like, it's not my line. It's from 1958, A Touch of Evil. Mm-hmm. And the guy says, we blew up the bomb. We blew it. And he said, just because he talks guilty doesn't make him innocent. And he was guilty at the end. Right. So anyway, so I guess that's as much as I can say about it. It was like Robin getting too angry at me.
So your basic thesis is that the problem of Barbie is not sufficiently addressed by the fact that they acknowledge and make fun of the problem of Barbie in the film.
It's also not, I mean, it would be different if it was a pure satire. Would not, see, this is what the Mattel toy company is behind the film.
Yeah.
It's kind of a long advertisement for itself or
absolutely.
Trying to justify itself. The other thing is, if you called it booby or something, you could do a satire
yeah.
about the same premise, but then by it not being the Barbie, you could do a real satire of it, which is not what it is.
Right.
It's more of a spoof than a satire. So that's my contentions.
All right.
Have you seen this yet?
I have not seen it.
Okay. All right.
All right. That's just about it for today's show. We will be back live in 2 weeks. We're going to have an interview with Fiona York about what's happening in advocacy within the homeless community in Vancouver now that the Crab Park camp has been shut down. Next week in the show, we will have an interview about student advocacy for students encountering trouble with the university. It's a very complicated issue and very difficult for many students. We'll be talking to the SFSS student advocate and the Graduate Student Society student advocate. That'll be next Monday. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
In the Barbie world, life is plastic.